Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. Welcome to another episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Becky Mockowitz, and she specializes in pediatric anesthesiology, very specifically cardiac pediatric anesthesiology, which is exceptionally rare in our field, and she is an expert in that subject. So today we wanted to do a very, very basic introduction of the field of pediatric anesthesia, some just basic physiology and pharmacology, what's different between pediatrics and adult anesthesia, just some considerations for that specialty. But before we dive into this episode, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and a little bit about your current practice.
Absolutely. So I started out as a PICU nurse, which I never thought I would do because in nursing school, I was like, I do not want to do peds. I do not want to do L&D. And somehow I ended up in the PICU. And so I sort of just started enjoying pediatrics. And when I went back to anesthesia school, that really was what I was drawn to. Like, it's all I wanted to do. So I went to the University of Alabama in Birmingham for my master's. And then 2 years ago, I went back to get my doctorate at Missouri State University. I am currently practicing in Austin, Texas. I work for a big anesthesia group that covers the pediatric hospital here. And so I do some general pediatrics and some peds cardiac. I just moved back to Austin from Philly, where I was working at CHOP, just doing pediatric hearts.
Just doing pediatric hearts.
No big deal.
No big deal. Yeah, actually, how Becky and I met was how many great CRNAs meet at the ANA Annual Congress. But we actually worked and taught at the same university, Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, while she was living here and was my go-to person if I wanted to go out and grab some coffee or an afternoon snack. So it was nice having Becky here. I'm sad that she's back in Austin, but I know that she's really happy being in her pediatric practice down there. So for this episode, where do we start? You want to do some physiology?
Absolutely. So let's dive into sort of the overview of peds physiology. And for the residents going through school, you're going to hear this 1,000 times during your pediatric rotation that kids are not small adults. Adults might be big kids, but kids are not small adults. So there's a lot of anatomy that's different with the pediatric patient that really plays into our anesthesia care. There's two big ones, their respiratory anatomy and physiology, and their cardiovascular anatomy and physiology. With the respiratory anatomy, especially the babies have a large occiput. So like the back of their head is really big and sort of causes them to tilt forward and occlude their airway. They also have big tongues and big tonsils and adenoids, and all of this causes upper airway obstruction, which we have to fight against because now we have the patient laying down and we're putting them to sleep so their airway muscles are relaxed. And so you're going to have a lot of obstruction with pediatric patients. They also have a really floppy epiglottis, and that makes it harder to lift when we're intubating. Physiologically, they have weaker respiratory muscles, so to compensate, they'll start breathing faster, so they'll have a higher respiratory rate, but they have a smaller tidal volume than the adult patients. They also have a lower FRC, so their residual volume is lower, and a higher O2 metabolism. So all this to say, when they start getting tired and they're not breathing, they're apneic because we're going off to sleep with anesthesia, they become hypoxic very quickly. So they're obstructing, they're becoming hypoxic, and this is going to lead to respiratory arrest, which is very common in the perioperative setting.
Yeah, I remember when I was doing my pediatric rotation, the very first thing that I realized that was very different between ped and adult airway anatomy, when you talk about the head, you know, with adults, when they lay flat, their heads are pretty much, their necks are neutral. So, you know, we often put adults in more of a sniffing position. What I was really surprised about is how every baby and child needed more of a shoulder roll to put them into more of a neutral or even head extension position, which is not something that we normally do with adults. So that was the first thing that I noticed, just the shoulder roll for everybody.
Yeah, and that's the thing I find that most learners struggle with is just getting the patient in the proper position to intubate, because adults kind of have a general sniffing position. You put the pillow under their head, they're happy. Kids are all different sizes. You're going to have a 6-month-old or you're going to have a 8-year-old. And so they're all going to need something different to get that head more in line so you have a good view of the airway.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you talk about respiratory reserve, despite giving them seemingly adequate oxygen, they desaturate very, very quickly. And from that, their vital signs will go with it. You know, become very bradycardic. And like you said, this can quickly lead to cardiac arrest. Not something that we typically think about with adults either during induction, especially.
Right. The adult patient can be apneic for a couple minutes while you're working on getting that tube in, but the pediatric patient will desat really quickly. And once they desat that first time, then subsequent intubation attempt, they're going to desat even faster.
Mm. Yeah, that's why when we do pediatric anesthesia, we always keep a little bit of emergency drugs on IM needles next to the machine. That's something that I learned to do. What types of emergency drugs do you have next to you just in case that happens?
So we're always going to have succinylcholine, atropine drawn up, ready to go. Some places don't really want you to draw it up, but you want to know the dose you're going to give of both of those drugs. I also like to have a little propofol as well as sort of a semi-emergency drug.
Mm-hmm. We used to have a little bit of epi drawn up as well, just in case they became severely bradycardic or arrested. But, you know, like you said, some places don't want you to do that. They feel like you're wasting the epi. And I'm like, I don't know. It's a child. I don't care how much I'm going to waste it. You know, once that happens to you, you don't forget it.
Exactly. And I'd rather have it ready to go, or at least know in my head. And that's something I really stress to the residents, is just knowing the dose you're going to give of these emergency drugs before you get in the situation where you need them.
Because you'll panic and then you won't be able to quickly calculate in your head the dose, not even just the dose, but just the mLs that you have to push, you know? Mm-hmm. And I used to do that too, where I would say, okay, what's the dose? But more importantly, what's the mLs? What does that look like in mLs? Because you just want to know right away, if this happens, I'm going to push 3 mLs of this drug or whatever the case may be.
And a lot of times you're not the one giving it. You're managing the airway still. So you're asking the circulating nurse to grab a drug and give it. So you want to be able to quickly articulate to them, like, I need you to give this drug in this volume.
Mm-hmm. And having those IM needles ready as well, because you might not even have an ID in at that point. A lot of things to keep in mind. That was respiratory. What about cardiac?
So cardiac-wise, the pediatric patient, their stroke volume is relatively fixed. So anytime they need to increase their cardiac output, the only thing they can do is compensate with an increased heart rate. So the average heart rate for a neonate is about 120 to 140. That's something also important to know, is what normal vital signs are going to be for your patient. If you have an adult patient whose heart rate is 120, that's really bad. But if you have a 1-month-old, you're like, oh, that's normal. Same thing with your blood pressure and MAPS. You want to know what the average vital signs are going to be for whatever age patient you have, and they can vary greatly. They also have an activation of the parasympathetic nervous system with anesthetic drugs, overdosing, and all of this will lead to bradycardia. So they they get bradycardic really easy with that activation. And so they'll decrease their cardiac output very easily. So as you're going off to sleep with anesthetic drugs, you're going to have a significant decrease of cardiac output. So again, you want to have those emergency drugs ready in case.
One thing to keep in mind is, you know, the way that you're, and we may go into this as we talk about more pharmacology, but the way that your inhaled anesthetics undergo uptake in the alveoli, a lot of that is dependent on heart rate. So you would think that the faster heart rate would be a higher and faster uptake, but it's actually the opposite. So a lower heart rate is the increased anesthetic uptake. And so with these neonates and these infants, they have a really, really fast heart rate. And we have to compensate that. One of the ways we compensate with that is that their MAC is a lot higher than the adult, especially during mask induction. And we're starting at max of SIVO in the upwards of 5 to 8% sometimes to start and then decreasing from there. But you also have to strike that balance between not overdosing as well and causing the opposite problem with the bradycardia.
Right. Especially if they have any sort of cardiac abnormality, they're going to be more sensitive to that higher MAC. But you also need that higher MAC to get them off to sleep.
Right.
A couple of other things that are physiologically special with our pediatric patients is their temperature control. They have a large surface area of their body per kilo, and they have thin skin. They typically have less fat stores than the adults, so the babies are going to get cold really fast. And so you'll notice the ORs for our pediatric patients are not frigid like the adult ORs. They're usually hot. We turn the temp up to 75, 80 degrees sometimes as we're getting these babies off to sleep, which I love personally, but as you are a learner, it can be really uncomfortable because you're getting nervous and your heart rate's up and you're sweating, and then the room temperature is 80 degrees and you feel like you're going to pass out. They also have immature kidneys and livers, and so this goes into the pharmacology kind of section, is their metabolism and excretion of drugs may be a lot slower, delayed. Some drugs may just not work as well for our pediatric patients because of their liver and kidney function.
Absolutely. So that's just a brief overview of the physiology. And certainly as we do subsequent episodes, we can take a deeper dive into some of these differences. But what age do you think, because you said, you know, babies and children are not small adults, but at some point the age, like, what do you think it feels like it's about the same as adults? When do you think that transition happens?
Most books say around 12 years old.
Okay.
The patient becomes more adult-like. I would say even like 8 years old, their anatomy is a little more adult-like.
It's kind of crazy. Some of the kids that we take care of are so massive nowadays. And I don't even mean fat-wise. Like, I've taken care of, you know, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds that were the size of adults, full-size adults. So that's so interesting because you're trying to keep in mind, you know, this is still an 8-year-old or this is still a 10-year-old, and they might have a lot of adipose tissue. And so it might change, you know, a lot of the weight-based dosing that we give, but we have to keep remembering, you know, what drugs are based on ideal body weight, what drugs are based on, you know, total body weight. Anatomically, are they still the size of a child underneath of all of the adipose tissue? So I think there's a lot of physiology comes into play when you're trying to make some of these anesthetic decisions for this population.
Yeah, we have some very large children, and then you have to think about their developmental phase too, because you have the, you know, kid that's your size and you're treating them like an adult, but really they're an 8-year-old and they're scared and they want their mom. And so all the growth and development plays into our anesthetic plan as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What about some pharmacology differences, just like an overview of some of the things to keep in mind for pediatrics?
So the big thing is everything is weight-based. So even I would say if I'm taking care of a 16-year-old, I'm still going to dose everything on weight. And so I love math, which I think is why I kind of like pediatric anesthesia, is because I am doing math all day long. And I like to be very specific with it. Yes, you can round once you know the number, but I always tell learners, please break out your calculator. Don't try to do this math in your head. If this is a kid, you don't want to mess up the math. So that is number one, is just knowing your dosages for everything. And for peds, the volume of distribution is different. They have more total water and less muscle and fat. And so you may need a higher dose per kilo for some drugs in the pediatric population than you would in the adult population. But then you have to take in consideration the renal and hepatic metabolism, so the duration of action can be longer of these drugs. So we may need to give more propofol or more paralytic, but then they may last longer than what they would with the adult patient. So you have to know your onsets and your half-lives of these drugs in the pediatric population. And like we talked about earlier, they need a higher MAC of our anesthetic gases. So you may have to run the gas higher than you would with an adult patient.
And there's other drugs too. So for drugs that maybe require a higher per kilo dose, drugs maybe like propofol, that's very, more lipid soluble. But then we have drugs like rocuronium. Rocuronium, I think, is so interesting because though the pediatric population has a total body water that is larger than adults, you would think that you would need more of a water-based drug like rocuronium, but their neuromuscular junctions are more immature than adults. So it balances back out, so the dose doesn't change. You have to know that about every single drug that you're giving, you know, what the difference is. It doesn't apply across the board. It doesn't mean that every drug is higher kilo.
And some drugs are more protein bound, and pediatric patients have decreased protein binding. So then you're going to have more free drug if it's a highly protein bound drug. So this is why we need to be experts in pharmacology as anesthesia providers, because we have to know all these nuances about the drug to know how to properly dose them.
So that's just a good introductory basic overview of some just like physiology and pharmacology differences. I know that when I was doing pediatric anesthesia, not just for my rotation, but I actually did it part of my clinical practice too. I was at a trauma center, an adult trauma center that did some peds. But I wasn't at a ped hospital like you are. What are the types of cases that you do in your practice? Maybe some of the kind of everyday bread and butter stuff to more of like the bigger cases that you do or the types of cardiac cases that you do.
I would say number one pediatric case you're going to see in a pediatric hospital or outside hospitals that do adults and peds are going to be ENT procedures like meningotomy and tube placements, so BMTs, and then tonsils and adenoids. That you're going to see that everywhere. So those are cases you should get really familiar with. Another big one we see is urology cases, especially circumcisions or inguinal hernia repairs. Sometimes urology does, sometimes general surgery does. Appendectomies are probably our number one like emergency case is an appendectomy at night. And then we do a lot of dental rehab, and I think this is a great thing for the residents, is because you're doing a lot of nasal intubations, so you're getting really good at nasal intubations with the dental rehabs for kids.
I think a lot of these kids also that have the dental need the dental rehab, from my experience, typically have some kind of developmental delay or mental retardation where it's difficult for them to have any kind of dental work while they're awake. So they need to be placed under anesthesia to have some dental work. So I think even that is a skill in itself, is how to deal with a child, especially a child that's a little big at this point that has a developmental delay, and how to put them under anesthesia. How to work with the parents. Sometimes you're having to do things like we call a ketamine dart, but I am ketamine injections, or trying to get them to drink some kind of potion to get them off the sleepy enough so that we could put in an IV. So even that in itself is not a skill that I ever thought I would have to develop.
Yeah, getting these kids to drink Versed. I mean, the Versed I hear does not taste really great. And so you have the kid that's like not excited to be there and has little special needs, and now you're trying to get them to drink this gross syrup. So they have, some places will do intranasal, which is a lot easier to sneak up and squirt something in their nose, but a lot of times those drugs take longer to work, and so you're having to balance that with the performance pressure of, you know, an OR and getting cases done.
And what type of cardiac cases do you do?
Cardiac cases, the big two are ASD and VSD repairs. And then probably a bigger case would be a tetralogy of flow repair. And these are just like adult cardiac cases. You're going on bypass. So you'll be on PAH, full open heart surgery. But sometimes the heart's as big as your paw.
Amazing. For the audience, ASD is atrial septal defect, and VSD is ventral septal defect. Yeah. I've only done like PDA clippings. I haven't patent ductus arteriosus clippings. I haven't done any cardiac, peds cardiac. I've done a lot of adult cardiac stuff. Have you done adults that you can, right? You've done some adults, right? Cardiac?
I haven't done adult anesthesia since school. So this is all very foreign to me.
That's hilarious, because I think anybody listening to this thinking, wow, pediatric cardiac anesthesia has to be one of the toughest specialties out there. I was just curious if you can state any differences between adult and peds cardiac for maybe people that have done adult cardiac. Would you feel like it's about the same?
Probably about the same. I know there's a few drugs that are a little bit different. And again, you know, everything's going to be weight-based. So your dose of heparin, you know, you might have in a 3 cc syringe instead of a 50 cc syringe. But overall, the process is relatively the same, especially if it's a, you know, full open heart surgery.
I imagine that the bypass machine is tiny.
I think it's about the same size. It's not the machine is the same. The circuit is different. So the diameter of the cannulas they use are based on the size of the heart. And they measure that. I know perfusion always wants to know the weight and height and like body surface area of the patient so they can pick the right cannula to use. And that's more between the perfusionist and the surgeon, but that's all we've discussed before surgery is like, how big of a cannula can we use for this patient? Because of course they want as big as they can.
So the circuit that they have is compatible with an adult bypass machine. It's not a different bypass machine.
Oh, okay. Same machine.
It's this massive, like this massive machine, right? Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Because we're doing, you know, anywhere from a kilo baby to a 120 kilo baby.
Right. Yeah. So you need to have something that's very, very, oh, I never thought of that. I thought it was just going to be this little like luggage size machine. Oh, that's interesting. All right. So those are some cardiac things that you do a lot. Yeah. Lots of dental rehab. Like you said, those nasal intubations. I'm trying to think of what other cases that I did for PED. We did a lot of plastic. We did a lot of cleft repairs. Yeah. We had a really, really great surgeon that did a lot of mission work as well. So she was awesome to work with. I felt like those kids were challenging as well. Yeah.
A couple of our bigger cases, and I feel like we do them a lot in the summer, are scoliosis. Fusions for scoliosis. That is a hot summer surgery. So we do a ton of those in the summer because it's when they're out of school. And another big one we do is craniosynostosis repair. So when the sutures of the skull are fused and the head's kind of misshapen, they go in and they basically cut up the skull and put it back together in a puzzle and rearrange. But because your scalp is so vascular, it's a lot of blood loss on a small baby. So you really have to stay on top of your fluid management on those patients.
Yeah. Yeah. Those scoliosis kids are super hard cases too, because like you said, it is a lot of blood loss, a lot of fluid shifting. They're prone, but also they get cold really, really fast. I find it's hard to keep them really warm, because especially if you're doing 13 level spine and the whole back is flayed open, you're trying to put a bear hugger basically on their head, arms, and their legs.
Knee for me.
Yeah, right. And they're sweating. Everybody's like not having a great time, but you know, very, very sick kids for sure. So for the next part of the episode, can you just walk us through basically a mask induction? Now, for those who are not familiar with adults, what we normally do to put adults to sleep is adults have get an IV placed in the pre-op area, and then they get IV medications to go off to sleep, like propofol. But for children, especially very, very young children, anywhere from infants to, what would you say, maybe 8 years old, need to have a mask induction? It just depends.
It really depends on the facility, what age they stop doing mask induction. At CHOP, we sort of had if they were 12 and up, they got an IV in pre-op.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't mean they're not getting a pre-med for the IV, but yeah, usually 12-ish and up, they'll get an IV. At my current facility, nobody gets an IV in pre-op. We do mask inductions on everyone.
It depends on the culture. For sure. Yeah.
Very much depends on the culture of the facility.
Yeah. Yeah. So for children, the ones that cannot have or cannot tolerate having an IV in the holding area have to go off to sleep using a mask induction. And that's where we place a mask over their face and they inhale anesthetic gases and to go off to sleep. And then during that time period, a second provider is trying to put an IV in and it goes from there. So just maybe starting from the holding area, can you walk us through how to get through a mask induction?
Yeah, so if the patient seems relatively cooperative, we'll just go back without a pre-med. If they seem really nervous and not excited about being there with us and being with strangers, they might get Versed pre-med in a liquid form before we go back. And then we roll back to the room. We hopefully get some monitors on them. Definitely uphold socks. Sometimes you just really can't get the other monitors on the kids if they're not really excited to be there. And we'll start with some nitrous oxygen mixture, usually about 30% FiO2, so 70% nitrous, and the kid will breathe that and start feeling a little goofy. And again, this depends on how cooperative the patient is. Some kids are super good with this. They get excited. They're breathing this mask that you put a flavor in and they're blowing up the balloon on the anesthesia machine. And then other kids are just like not having it at all. So with the cooperative kids, you need to go with the nitrous. And once they start feeling silly, if they're really good, you can do the IV at that point. If they're kind of more at that younger age, we'll then turn on the SIBO and slowly crank that up to 8% SIBO, which is the max. If the kid's super uncooperative, a lot of times we'll just go straight to 8% SIBO. And it doesn't smell great, but it doesn't smell bad. And usually about 3 or 4 good deep breaths, the kid will be all the way off to sleep with the mask. Once they're asleep is when we'll do the IV. So then a second provider will do the IV. Where I work, we always have an anesthesiologist available for induction, and they'll do the IV while the CRNA is masking the patient.
Okay, so the anesthesiologist helps place the IV. Now at this point, they are still under the gas. You're ready to intubate. And then do they push medications before you do your intubation?
Usually if we're intubating, they'll give at least propofol, and depending on the case, a paralytic agent. If we're placing an LMA, typically the 8% SIBO is enough to get the LMA in.
Nice. Yeah, so the propofol, just to get them a little touch deeper, to place the breathing tube. I find that for adults, we have a really low threshold to push a paralytic, but for children, we're a little bit more thoughtful about it. We don't just seemingly just freely give it to every child, you know, especially before. Can children get to Gamidex?
Yep.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
FDA approved 2 and up, and they're working on less than 2.
Yeah, so that's another consideration. Like before we had Sugammadex, and when we were training, all we had was neostigmine, and that has, problems with children as well. So we had to be really thoughtful about our giving paralytics to children. We don't just give it to, if we could get away with not giving it, then we won't give it. We'll just try to get it deep.
I would say at least 75% of cases I do not give a paralytic. I've even done laparoscopic surgery without paralytic, which we would never do with an adult patient.
But children just don't have the muscle tone that adults do. So they're a lot more floppy. They are a lot more, their tissues are a lot more compliant. So they don't really need it for a lot of cases. Yeah. So I think that's great for our first episode to just do an overview of Pharm and Phys and some basic cases and induction. What are some, some takeaways for people that are maybe considering doing some pediatrics as part of their anesthesia practice when they graduate? What are some kind of takeaways or things that people should consider?
Well, first, just because you didn't do pediatric before school doesn't mean you cannot do pediatrics after. Most of my coworkers were adult ICU nurses, so that's not, a thing you have to worry about. And I know the peds rotation can be really scary for most people. So I had a student that had never even held a baby before she came through for her pediatric rotation, and she was so nervous, and it's like, it's going to be okay. We're going to help you through it. So just know you're not going to be thrown out on an island on your own as a resident or even as a new CRNA. A lot of places will give a lot more orientation in the pediatric world than they do in the adult world.
Yeah, I don't think I was left alone for a long time in my peds rotation or ever for the 3 months that I was there. I told myself that I wasn't going to do peds when I graduated. That was not the thing that I ever wanted to do. Something I ever did. I always did adults. That I liked adults. And like I said, I was at this trauma center where they did quite a bit of peds. It was, I would say, a center that served, more underserved populations. So we had lots of pediatrics that didn't have insurance that came through. And there were a lot of people that cross-trained in both. And I, like I said, that's not something I ever thought I would find myself doing. And then here I was all of a sudden on the pediatric team there, the anesthesia team, even doing cases where, this is probably normal for you, but for me, this was terrifying, where we had to go to the NICU and do cases in the little OR up there, we had to do some kind of like X-lab cases for maybe some neck fash, GI neck fash, or like I said, the PDA clippings, things that I never thought that I would have to learn, like oscillators, right? That's not something that I ever, not even in anesthesia school, we never even talked about it. And now I'm, of course we have respiratory there, but understanding oscillators, understanding things like giving blood in that population. So there's a reason why we have those pediatric rotations. And I think I learned the most on those rotations more than anything else.
And that's something for the residents out there to be really mindful of. Yeah, you may not want to do peds, but if you're working at a critical access hospital, you never know what's going to come through the ED and need emergency surgery. So you have to be ready for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And I think that after working at a place like that, where you had to cross train in so many different specialties, after I left and went to other hospitals, I felt like I could handle any case. Felt like there was nothing that they could throw at me that I couldn't handle, because I had taken care of the entire spectrum of, the population. So always great to establish a good foundation in pediatrics.
Exactly.
Often. Well, thank you so much for joining us for the podcast today. We definitely are interested in doing more pediatric topics. So if there's a topic out there that you, the residents and the nurses want to hear, please let us know. And Becky, if there's a resident out there that wants to get in touch with you to talk to you more about your specialty and the type of practice that you have, where can people reach you?
Sure. Please absolutely reach out to me. My email address is Becky, BECKYMOT @gmail.com.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. See you in the next one.
Thanks.